Case number 12-3110, United States of America v. Duane McKinney, appellant. Ms. Davis for the appellant, Mr. Light for the appellee.
Ms. Davis, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Mary Davis. I represent the appellant, Mr. Duane McKinney. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal. This is Mr. McKinney's second time before the court on the Edwards issue. As the court is aware, the case was remanded back to the district court for a determination of whether Mr. McKinney had a severe mental illness at the time of trial, and if so, whether he should be granted a new trial. Trial in this case began in January 2008, and it concluded April 2008. Dr. Pyant, the expert who did the evaluation, the most recent evaluation of Mr. McKinney, did the evaluation between August and December of 2011. The determination, therefore, was made over 4.5 years after trial, and it was Dr. Pyant's job to determine whether Mr. McKinney, at the time of trial, was suffering from a severe mental illness. Assuming at this point that a retrospective determination is even possible so many years later, we submit that the trial judge's findings of fact were clearly erroneous.
Well, why isn't it possible if he looked at contemporaneous evidence, which he did? He did review some of the trial transcript, as I recall, not the April proceedings, but the January, isn't that
right? Dr. Pyant, I believe, looked at only 4 days of trial transcripts.
All right.
He did not see in those 4 days of transcripts many of the things that were brought out during the hearing in this case back in October, I believe it was, such as the trial judge's opinion that there is something very wrong with Mr. McKinney. Trial counsel or standby counsel stated on the record that Mr. McKinney was irrational, and if that's the way he is thinking, then there's something very, very wrong with him. Dr. Pyant didn't see any of these things, but at the same time, when asked would these things have made a difference, he said they could have made a difference, but he wasn't aware of them.
But Dr. Pyant had all of the previous, I think, with the exception of the first doctor, Anderson, had all of the your client has had multiple competency hearings.
Yes, he has.
And Pyant, as I understand it, reviewed most of them. And those were contemporaneous or a lot closer to the trial than he was.
There was only one that was conducted during the course of trial, a full-scale evaluation, and that was Dr. Kunick's evaluation. That was when Mr. McKinney was first sent down to Butner.
And then you've got Cautious.
Dr. Cautious, who
March of
right,
all,
he yeah. was a defense expert, and it was his belief that Mr. McKinney was suffering from a mental illness, right,
bipolar
disorder.
Okay.
Also, there in what Dr. Pyant didn't review were any of the BOP records, which indicated that Mr. McKinney was on antipsychotic medication before, during, and after trial. And this wasn't contrary to what the government asserted. This wasn't just Mr. McKinney self-reporting. This was reports by doctors that interviewed him and did evaluations of him when he was in the federal system. Dr. Pyant didn't review any of these things. The court did not. I did not see where the trial judge even acknowledged any of this. The reports also indicated that Mr. McKinney had a diagnosis of depression with psychotic features. Dr. Pyant didn't consider that, but he said it could have been important to him, but he never reviewed it. He didn't talk to defense counsel. He did not review school records. Again, he did not review all the trial transcripts. He did a very, very cursory review of prior evaluations and saw Mr. McKinney 4 times.
So you started out by saying the district court's findings were clearly erroneous.
Yes.
And we remanded for the court to exercise its discretion to make a determination as to whether your client was suffering from a severe mental illness. So when you say clearly erroneous, is it the argument that because Dr. Pyant himself did not look at the whole trial transcript and did not do all the other things you were discussing with Judge Henderson, that we necessarily must find that the district court abused its discretion?
I believe so, because the district court...
I just want to be clear what you think the standard of review is.
Right. The district court based its most recent opinion, decision, on Dr. Pyant's testimony for the most part.
So it was an abuse of discretion for him to rely on Dr. Pyant, assuming that's what he did?
Yes, I would.
So you agree it is an abuse of discretion standard of review?
I would agree that it is, yes.
All right. So when Dr. Pyant said he was familiar with records at Butner as to how Ms. McKinney had behaved and that type of thing, of course, he was totally familiar with your client's conduct at trial and what defense counsel had said at various times.
I'm sorry, who was aware? The trial judge or Dr. Pyant was aware?
Dr. Pyant.
Dr. Pyant was not aware.
I said Dr. Pyant was aware of the records at Butner. He talked about the other doctors.
The other evaluations, yes.
Evaluations.
Right.
And he said he thought he had enough information.
Exactly, based
on the trial judge was aware of the entire trial and defense counsel's several statements. So I just want to understand, what would this court be holding in saying that it's an abuse of discretion for the district court under those circumstances?
To rely on Dr. Pyant's testimony, because Dr. Pyant's evaluation was very superficial and it didn't follow the standard norm of what should be done in order to determine competency.
And where do we find that standard norm?
The standard norm is, I think I cited a couple reports in my brief of what should be done in order to determine.
And was all that brought to the district court's attention?
It was not brought to the district court's attention.
Just let me pursue a little bit Judge Rogers' question, because I'm looking at Edwards. I mean, the language, the Supreme Court in Edwards was extremely clear about who it wanted to be making these decisions. It talks about, says, the district judge will often prove best able to make what he calls the court more fine-tuned mental capacity decisions tailored to individualized circumstances of particular defendant. And it refused to set a specific, it's basically telling the courts of appeals that this is a job for the district court to weigh all the evidence and make the fine-tunes. And it's, I'm not sure when I see this kind of language how, given that, you would argue that we should set what he did aside. In fact, didn't he do just what the court said here, the district judge?
The court made a finding that Mr. McKinney did not suffer from a severe mental illness. Mm-hmm. It is, but at the same time, the district court made
a
finding.
That's the Edwards issue, correct?
Excuse me, yeah, right.
That is the Edwards issue.
Right. But at the same time, the court...
And it's the one we directed on remand.
Exactly. At the same time, though, the court made a finding that Mr. McKinney suffered from personality disorders. Right. And I believe it was Dr. Koenig said there's a provisional diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder. It is our position that that finding that he suffered from something that was and the judge also said, and it interfered with his ability to represent himself. So under Edwards, the fact that he had a mental illness that interfered.
No, the district court found he did not have a mental illness.
The district court found he had a behavioral.
Isn't that different from a severe mental illness?
I believe it is not different.
Really?
Because number one, Edwards doesn't define what severe mental illness is. Edwards also talks about, you know, the gray area defendant, the somewhat competent defendant. There's nothing in Edwards saying what a severe mental illness is. However, at the same time, and it's cited in my brief, that, and indeed the DSM, says the difference between Axis 1 diagnosis and Axis 2 diagnosis doesn't mean that anyone is more severe than the other. If Mr. McKinney has an access to diagnosis, contrary to what Dr. Pyant said, then the access to diagnosis could qualify as a severe mental illness. But the district court didn't consider this. The district court only considered, based on Dr. Pyant's testimony, that only an access 1 diagnosis can qualify as a severe mental illness.
Did he actually say that?
Dr. Pyant?
No, the district court.
The district court said that he believed that he had behavioral disorder.
But he didn't say what you just said he said, right?
He never said,
I'm only going to consider.
No, he didn't, right. but he based his, you know. But
so the Supreme Court says that what it's concerned about, all right, while it doesn't define, as you point out, it says, insofar as a defendant's lack of capacity threatens an improper conviction or sentence. All right?
Yes.
So the judge, having heard from Dr. Pyant, having seen the defendant, he refers to these other evaluations as well, at one point says, you know, your client was gaming the system. And isn't that the type of evaluation that, you know, the district court is in the best position to evaluate once he's considered whatever expert testimony is before him?
Because going back to what the court considered, the court, I think it's very clear that the court did not consider this other evidence that he did, in fact, have an Access 1 diagnosis. That was that the court just disregarded that. And it's our position that the district court has to consider all the evidence before it, not just the reports out of Butner and not just Dr. Pyant's testimony. The court should consider everything, and it does not appear that the court did.
Okay,
thank you.
We'll give you a couple times couple minutes in reply. Mr. Light?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Gilead Light. I represent the United States.
Can I ask you, before you start, and you didn't argue this, and I want to ask you why. This was a very sophisticated crime, and his restitution order is almost $1 million. Can we consider that at all? In other words, if he was able to pull off this elaborate fraud over a long period of time and have assessed against him almost $1 million in restitution, can we consider that in considering what we're supposed to be looking at, severe mental illness?
I believe it's in the record, and for sure this court could consider this defendant's sophistication, his level of ingenuity as evidence of competence.
But you don't argue that, do you?
Well, we reference it, I believe, in a footnote. Okay. The nature of mental illness is up and down, and someone can be competent one day and then not competent the next. And if anything, that's why we felt it wasn't the strongest avenue to pursue. But for sure, that is in the record. And
well, the district court mentioned it in connection with what he thought the appellant was doing here.
That's right. And the trial judge specifically noted that he pulled off this elaborate scheme, and he was trying to continue his scheming here in the courtroom by motioning for to represent himself the day of trial, not months before, after he'd gone through 5 or 6 different counsel. And then after he'd seen the weight of the evidence against him 3 days into the trial, but at a time when the government had nearly rested, then he throws a curveball and motions that he himself is incompetent to proceed.
So the district court comments that, you know, he wishes the Supreme Court had provided more guidance, and he's obviously troubled. And some of the things appellant's counsel just said were the things that were troubling the district court. And he knew he had an expert who had interviewed the appellant but had not reviewed the contemporaneous trial record and was not aware of a lot of different things. And so what's the minimum that would have to be considered on a remand like this?
Well, this court stated that the minimum had already been accomplished. There were contemporaneous records and evaluations that were performed at the time of trial.
The doctor didn't look at them.
Dr. Pyant didn't look at them. I'm referring to, in terms of the minimum that the trial court would have to look at.
No, but I'm saying, appellant's argument is you have a doctor who 4.5 years later talks to appellant, but doesn't read the relevant materials. So his evaluation is necessarily deficient, is the nature of the argument I understand being made. And so that's why I asked the government, you know, what's the minimum here?
Well, we submit that the expert did read the relevant materials.
He said he didn't.
Some of the relevant, that some materials that could have been relevant. That's how he characterized it. Certain things were brought to his attention that he did not read. Most of them from after the point where the defendant had cut off the trial to motion himself incompetent. But he did review the trial transcript leading up, and most importantly, he read Dr. Kunick's April or March of 2008 detailed report in which she specifically analyzes both his competence to stand trial as well as the competence to represent himself at trial. And that's before Edwards had even come out, that she was looking at that issue. And he states that even though he could have considered other issues or other facts, he felt he had enough and he felt confident in his diagnosis of the defendant in that he did not suffer a severe mental illness or an Axis I mental disorder.
How about the antipsychotic medicine? Pyant says that he wasn't prescribed that at Butner. Is that right? But that he was back in February of 2009. In other words, in 2011, when Pyant examines him, he's not on antipsychotic medication. But he was when he was sentenced.
He was by
the Bureau of Prisons. And it's unclear to me that when he started taking these antipsychotics, I know he said he told them he was taking them during the trial, but is that clear from the record?
I don't think it's clear from the record exactly when he was either taking the medications, when he was prescribed the medications, or if he actually took medications that were prescribed. I think that's largely an issue of speculation. There is record evidence that there were prescriptions in his name and that he reported taking medications, but it's not clear whether or not he was actually taking these at the time of the trial or what the specific diagnosis was at the time of the trial. The only specific diagnosis we have at the time of the trial is Dr. Kunick's, which unequivocally concludes that there was no severe mental illness. And for that reason, the trial judge's determinations can't be clearly erroneous. He had multiple points of factors to consider beyond just those reports. He had Dr. Kunick's report. He had Dr. Pyant's evaluations of those reports and current evaluations of the defendant. He had his own personal firsthand interactions. And that's why, as the Edwards court stated, he was in a unique position to make a finely tuned mental capacity decision. He did that, and it wasn't clear error.
What do you do with, what about the defendant's argument that when you look at the last sentence of the district court's decision, I think it's the last sentence, it's clear he didn't make an Edwards finding. His decision was that the defendant had, quote, the ability to make an informed decision about his desire to represent himself, and that he was, in fact, competent to make that decision. That's not the Edwards finding.
That's right, Your Honor, and focusing on just that one sentence of the holding.
That's his last sentence, which starts out, you know, it is my view. And that's the way he finishes. It's not the Edwards. You agree that's not the Edwards point?
We'd agree that within the parameters of that single sentence, that
so
the Edwards,
find the Edwards point,
we find it in the totality of the circumstances. Okay. This was the only issue that was remanded to the district court. He specifically sent out for a competency evaluation about the ability to represent oneself at trial. The expert came in and testified about the issue to testify at trial. And the court's order, which is the last page of the record, I believe it's 188, specifically denies the defendant's motion about reconsidering the decision to permit the defendant to represent himself, not about a Feretta issue and not about a mental competence Dusky issue. So it's inconceivable to think that This trial judge was considering any other question but the single unitary question that was before the court. There was no other reason to hold the hearing other than the mental competence to proceed pro se under Edwards.
And one other question. What about the fact that it was Dr. I think the only doctor who actually looked at the Edwards question was Dr. Pine, right? He's the only one who actually looked at the question of whether he was competent to represent.
Dr. Kunick also looked at this issue. She was before her time. It was before Edwards had come out. But I believe that Judge Walton, anticipating the need that Edwards was being considered, as he stated on the record, that he knew the Supreme Court was considering this issue. If you look at the docket entry.
I'm looking at what my notes are. So Kunick, you're talking about Kunick now?
Yes, and on the
Kunick,
last page of her report.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. What?
On the last page of Dr. Kunick's report, page 10 of 10 of her report in 2008, the very last section is a single heading that says defendant's capacity or defendant's competence to proceed pro se. In addition to mental competence, to stand trial.
Okay.
She specifically looked at that issue. The order from Judge Walton in 2008 requested that that second issue be looked at as well as just the regular competence to stand trial. So the trial judge, as early as 2008, knew this issue was coming. This was the whole question at the time when the defendant, after representing himself through 3 days of trial and after performing admirably in some respects, winning objections, moving items into evidence, having discussions with witnesses that were clearly competent on many levels, although not necessarily effective, then he made this motion to declare himself incompetent. And that's what the judge was concerned with.
And final question for me. What about the McKinney's argument that the district courts, this dichotomy between a personality disorder and a severe mental illness isn't accurate, that a personality disorder can be the result of a severe mental illness?
Well, and I see my time is expiring, so I'll just wrap up with this last question. But these are additional facts that were never before the district court. These are attempts to impeach the expert opinion of Dr. Pyant when he's not there to either contradict them or...
The district court said... No severe mental illness, but a personality disorder. The district court made that finding, right? Didn't he?
That I believe, not maybe necessarily in the same sentence, but that is the essence of what he found.
Yes. And the defendant's argument is, well, that's a falsity. That a personality disorder can flow from a severe mental disorder.
If that is a false dichotomy, if there is scientific evidence to support that was never before the trial judge. That's all being brought out on appeal after he's had a chance, when he's not had a chance to look at it.
Well, I mean, I think, isn't the argument here that, first of all, the district court didn't make the proper finding? Second, the district court didn't look at the relevant evidence. Third, the district court had this false dichotomy that colored his whole interpretation of what he was about. And if you look at it that way, it's almost tantamount to a plain error type argument. I mean, if the premise of his thinking was flawed, then don't we have a different situation?
Well, the premise of his thinking in terms of the Edwards issue was not flawed because he is supposed to see if there is a severe mental illness, but then make his own determination using the expert's opinions, using
the
conclusions of...
When the judge is musing and says, you know, I wish the court had given us more guidance, he's concerned about this notion that, you know, this is just a personality disorder. So that's sort of his premise that appellant...
And I think that's fair. That's why he decided when this court left the door open for him to not leave his chambers and resolve the case with a written issue, he decided to hold another competency hearing. He didn't have to do that. And that competency hearing was specifically aimed at gathering more information on that very issue that you suggest. And the defense presented no evidence during that competency hearing. All they did was cross-examine the government's expert, and that expert conclusively stated that the defendant was not suffering from a severe mental illness. So again, if to the extent that the defense is arguing that the conclusion is flawed or that it's the judge is arguing on a faulty premise, that evidence wasn't before the trial judge. And he made a conclusion that was based both on the forensic psychologist's analysis as well as his own interactions with the defendant. I think that is particularly important here. He watched this defendant at the time of trial operate in the courtroom. He interacted with him extensively, both during Feretta inquiries and throughout the course of the trial in speaking with him. He saw how he operated, and he noted the sophistication of the original crime. So there's no clear error, then, in the judge's finding because he had so many independent bases for his finding that this defendant did not suffer from a severe mental illness to the point that it rendered him incompetent to represent himself at trial.
And do you agree the standard of review is abuse of discretion?
No, I do not, Your Honor.
The you think standard it's clear error? Because I noticed the circuits are split on this. And I wondered, do you want us to join that split and which side?
We would want you to come down on the clear error side of that split, Your Honor. This was a factual determination. This is about a specific individual's competence. And there's so many factors that go into it, especially considering the Supreme Court's guidance that the law and legal standards for competence should not be staked to the standards set by forensic psychology. They're very clear about that, that forensic psychology is a guidepost, but the individual circumstances are important, too. And a trial judge has to make his own finely tuned mental capacity decision based on all the evidence around him. That's a factual finding, and that is a clearly erroneous standard, and that's what we have here.
Well, really, the Supreme Court did a very unusual thing by adding that appendix. In other words, to show that this man had one of his motions or something that they appended, this particular man, based on the evidence, which to me indicates the standard of review is clear error, that you look at the defendant before you, how he acts, you make the finding of whether he has severe mental illness. Let me ask you about your reading of Edwards. And we even said on remand that even were the district court to find severe mental illness, it could then use its discretion about whether he could continue to represent himself. Do you know of any case where after finding severe mental illness, a judge has allowed a defendant to continue to represent himself?
I personally have not seen such a case yet, but for sure that would be possible under that Edwards standard. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier, that the clinical forensic diagnosis, and we put quotes around severe mental illness because that has a term in forensic psychology, that is the starting point of the analysis. It's not the entire analysis. It's not if he has bipolar, then he's incompetent. And it's not if he doesn't have bipolar, then he is competent. That's not how it works. That's just the starting point. If you could analogize it, it's almost like the sentencing guidelines. Judges are supposed to consult the guidelines and reach a number of months. But that's just their starting point. And then they're free to go on and make their own decision based on the totality of the circumstances, the unique circumstances of that particular defendant. That's a rough analogy, but that's what Edwards is asking the courts to do here. It confers discretion. It permits them to make that finding and not to refuse to, you know, allow a trial judge to refuse a defendant the right to represent himself. I think that what's important in conclusion, and I know I'm way over my time, but is that the Supreme Court in Edwards is focused on the right of the defendant to reaffirm the defendant's dignity in the courtroom. So that mental competence doesn't render him a lunatic in the courtroom such that he embarrasses himself in front of the jury and all but assures himself a conviction. That's not what happened here. This was a very able defendant. He secured himself some acquittals. He consulted with his standby counsel. So and the trial judge notes all that he did an admirable job, if not an effective job, of demonstrating his competence to function in the courtroom.
I know you're way over your time, but that standby counsel element is interesting here. I mean, how that factors in exactly. I mean, once you've made the determination that the defendant is competent to consult with counsel, and advised counsel, and the defendant here actually turned over certain functions to standby counsel. It's a more complicated scenario.
Well, I think that's right, and later on he did turn over functions to standby counsel, but the basic point I was trying to make is that the trial judge used his own eyes, his own detective functioning to figure out whether this defendant was competent.
Which is what Edwards said to do.
That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we ask that you affirm the judgment of the trial court below. Thank you.
All right. Why don't you take a minute, Ms. Davis?
I would like to make, I think, just 2 points. Number one is regard to Dr. Kunick's evaluation. Although there is a heading that says competency to waive right to counsel and to act pro se, if the court actually reads that paragraph, there isn't a finding by Dr. Kunick that he was competent to represent himself. I mean, that's really not what she's saying. And Dr. Kunick's evaluation suffers from the same flaws that Dr. Pyant's suffers from. Number one, she had very few meetings with Mr. McKinney. She got very angry at Mr. McKinney and, in fact, had him put into a lockdown ward because he refused to meet with her. But she did find a provisional diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder, which we submit is the same thing, even if the trial judge found that there was a behavioral problem, and that interfered with Mr. McKinney's ability to represent himself competently. According to the trial judge, he said that based on expert opinions that Mr. McKinney has a personality disorder, and basically as a result of this personality disorder, he thought he could be a better lawyer than the lawyers he had. And this, we believe, satisfies Edwards because of his mental defect. It led him to act in such a way that was detrimental to him and resulted in a very unfair trial. And I think a whole take-home point of Edwards is that you have to ensure a fair trial. The government has a duty to ensure a fair trial. And Mr. McKinney was not at all competent to represent himself. He was ridiculous. I'm not going to go through every instance, but reading through those transcripts, he made no sense much of the time. And that was as a result of his personality disorder or his depression or his bipolar disorder. We don't know what it is because Mr. McKinney doesn't let anyone get near him. But there's obviously something wrong with him, and we believe we satisfied the Edwards standard.
All right. Okay, thank you.